but that the asset or the ore body straddles both Argentina and Chile. As we understand it, there's a bilateral agreement between the two, but how do you practically think through that? Is it twice as many environmental approvals, improvals with the native titles?
Where we're at right now, which is exploration, we have this agreement that exists. It effectively, we sort of control the border ourselves. So really the only rules are if you go in from Chile, you have to exit the project from Chile and vice versa. Obviously, complications as you start moving towards production. And what it means really is a duplicate of reporting.
In my interpretation, to kind of get the most out of the project in the long run, it'd probably require a desalination plant and a pipeline from the coast to provide that water.
90% of what's sort of what we found and almost all of the drilling that we're doing right now is entirely in Argentina. We have access to groundwater there. You know, the long-term, I guess, plan B here is it wouldn't take that much for the broader Lundin Group to think about building out that desalination facility, tying into the Caserones water pipeline, and then ultimately being able to deliver desalinated water up to the high Andes.
Right, g'day, Money Miners. We're heading across the ditch to the remote area, not physically, but we're talking about the Filo del Sol project today with the CEO of Filo Corp, Jamie Beck. This thing is fucking huge. It's going to be huge. It's on the border of Argentina and Chile. It's a massive epithermal porphyry copper gold silver deposit. Well, they got a couple of billion market cap for an exploration company.
Canadian $2.5 billion market cap. It's still early stage. Not even any guidance for a mineral resource for the whole thing yet. Mm. I mean, it's fascinating because here in Australia and on the ASX, we really lack a good copper development story. So you have to kind of look to the North Americans to get that. This one is a bit of a standout when you look at the universe of great undeveloped potential projects that could be like you look at it and you think this has the potential to, you know, be decades, potentially even century long mining at some point given its scale, but it's still early stage and keen to really learn about it, Matty.
Yeah, it looks like, and you looked at, I think it was, what was it, over 7 kilometres strike, and they're hitting mineralisation still at 1,800 metres deep. Like, it's phenomenal. But as you said, once the resource comes out in the future, we'll see how the grade stacks up against deposits like OU Tolgoi and Casabel and other large-scale operations like that, and your Escondidas and all
that. Yeah, your Chiqui Camatas and the like in the area.
Yeah, so, no, interesting. Boys, we intro'd in there. Let's get into it. Sponsor for this episode. Who else would you pick that could maybe service the Filo del Sol project?
Anytime exploration services would be my go-to call, Matty.
Because they could service at any time, but with their anywhere mandate, anywhere, if they need a bit of Australian exploration experience just to tick the diversity box, I reckon Seamus Murphy could send a heap of lads and ladies over there to help drill some 1,800 metre deep holes and collect and cut the core of 1,800 metres worth of fucking hole.
I've got a bit of a word about these guys, Matty.
Word on the decline.
They don't just do exploration, they also do production.
Do they?
So it's anything as well.
Anything. They do mining, they do bloody, they could, they're probably going to get into, if they get this contract, they'll get a plane. They do, they hire out utes, LVs and bloody trucks and everything. Word on the decline, Seamus is going to get a Learjet to take the workers over to the Andes.
Can you imagine how big the core shed they'd have as well, Matty? Over 120 kilometres of drilling already. It's all there, you know, it'd be all over it.
Can Seamus do... Talk about clipping a ticket. If we can get Seamus this contract, boys, we are set.
Can Seamus do any altitude?
Any altitude, anytime, anywhere, any altitude.
4,000 metres, doesn't matter. Yeah. Doesn't matter.
Mate, get on to anytime exploration. Actually, probably get in quick before he gets the Filo del Sol contract.
He'll be maxed out.
And because... that'll be a priority. So probably get in now before that happens and we clip the ticket. Thanks anytime for your support. Love your work, Seamus and Victoria. Right, boys, let's get into it. Chat with CEO Jamie Beck from Filo Corp. Rip it. Here we go. Righto, Money Miners, here we go. We're heading over to Chile and Argentina, right on the line. We've got Jamie Beck, CEO and President of Philo Mining. Got him on for a bit of a grilling today.
It's Philo Corp now, Matty. Philo. Change
Philo
of name.
Philo Corp, yeah. When we say grilling, Jamie, it ain't your usual investor relations fluff fest, mate. We hopefully got some good questions for you, mate, and it should be a good yarn.
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Absolute pleasure, mate. Now, yeah, background for everyone. We went through it a bit at the start. Philo Corp, Canadian $2.5 billion exploration company listed on the TSX, got a long and intriguing history. So they're onto a huge epithermal copper, gold, silver deposit in the South American Andes. And when you think Andes, you think high altitude and dry and in the middle of nowhere. 4,000 metres above sea level. I remember walking around Peru and I couldn't even bloody breathe walking up the hill. I think that was only 2,000 or 3,000. So how do you go up 4,000 metres, Jamie?
Yes, you need to watch our drillers from Salta who are up there smoking cigarettes on the side of the drill. No
problem. You'd be lucky to light the bloody thing, I'd think. I'm sure you're well aware of these hits, Jamie, since you've run the show. 1.4 kilometres at 1.13 copper equivalent, 1.2 kilometres at 0.83 copper equivalent. So she's a bit bigger than the copper intersections we see in Australia, money miners. And look, no point me talking about this. Jamie, you're a Lundin Group company. Tell us a bit about that, Lundin being the biggest shareholders.
Yeah, you know, a number of different publicly traded companies across the energy sector. There's an oil and gas side as well as the mining side, typically split between either commodity and or stage of development. So Philo is one of the groups. Junior, call it exploration or discovery companies in the base metal space. Lundin Mining, of course, being the senior producer and the one that's actually digging stuff out of the ground. So that, you know, what binds us together is family ownership, and that's really the theme that runs through all of it. And in our case, the Lundin family holds about 33% of the outstanding shares. And you'll see that across many of the different Lundin Group companies, you'll have sort of shared board members, and we try and trade experience across the group companies that way.
Sorry, JD, BHP, they're in for 5% as well, aren't they?
They actually just we raised some money in May, June this year, and BHP actually just increased their stake, so they sit around 6% now.
Jamie, I'm really interested to get into the exploration story. The Aussie market loves a nice discovery story, and the discovery sort of along the Philo trend has been actually a long time in the making. In various incarnations, there's been companies exploring there for the better part of a quarter century now. So I'm interested for you to sort of flesh out. There was even a PFS and a PEA that came out in the late 2010s for you to explain the sort of story to the Aussie market.
Sure. I mean, I'll go quick. The Lundins first got involved in Argentina through a bid for Baja de Alumbrera, which was a big copper porphyry in Catamarca province. That ended up being subject to a hostile takeout, but the family had generated all this in-country expertise. They had legal advisors and geologists and financial advisors. So they decided to leverage their experience there and put that team to find the next thing. And they discovered the Veladero deposit, which was in a company called Argentina Gold. That continues to be one of Barrick's big gold producing operations, 500 some odd thousand ounces a year. After Argentina Gold was again taken out by hostile takeout, the same team of geologists went and pieced together this land package that we're working today. And that would have been the late 1990s. And you sort of have the Maricunga Belt, which was very prolific to the north. You've got El Indio, which was to the south. And there had been this, I don't know, geologic dogma that there was some kind of gap in between these two, prolific mining belts in the Andes. And our guys went in on horseback and mule, and soil sampling, came up with 15, 16 different targets. And through various corporate entities throughout a bit of history, they were in Tenke mining for a little while when Tenke Fungurume, which is an asset we own in the DRC, DRC was in civil war and Tenke needed some news flow. So we jammed all these Argentine assets into Tenke mining. Once the DRC picked up again and we started working there, these got spun out into what became NGX Resources. And NGX Resources at the time had really made a couple of big discoveries. Jose Maria, which is a deposit that sits about 12 kilometers to our east, Los Helados, which sits to our north, and Filo del Sol, which was really early stage. And Filo struggled through those early years to really garner the attention. Dollars were being raised in equity markets, and those dollars were going into the sort of more advanced projects at the time. So in 2016, we spun off Filo into its own company, Filo Mining. We raised money and we went out to explore specifically for the oxides that are shallow and outcropping at surface. We pieced together a resource around that oxide and started walking down the line of engineering studies. So we did a PEA, we moved onwards towards a pre-feasibility study. That's a nice little project. So somewhere around 2018-19, we were faced with a decision as to whether or not the board and management, we wanted to put that oxide heap leach project into production, or as the geologists wanted us to do, focus back towards the drill bit. We'd never drilled at depth and we'd never drilled underneath, despite knowing that, you know, the plumbing was in place. There must have been some engine driving the placement of the metals in the oxide deposits, and we'd not really explored for it. So we've put the engineering work on pause and went back to the drill bit. And really the success from there has guided the story. It's been, Matt, some of those intersections you listed off at the opening, just dramatic success with the drill bit, some of the best copper gold intersections in the world over the past few years, and continues to get bigger.
Jamie, the story of Vicuña is sort of paramount to the story of Filo, and our audience being, primarily Australian ASX familiar listeners and viewers won't be as familiar with the emerging Vicuña copper district as the Canadian audience would be, I imagine. But understanding the project and also frankly why BHP gives a crap is kind of part and parcel of what we'll try and convey in this piece. To sort of set the scene, like this, the central Andes, as I understand it, is a bit like the Saudi Arabia of the copper business. Chuquicamata has produced copper in that area for over a century. Escondida has, over 30 years of mining production. But if you look at the resource, it'll be producing for over a century itself. And the interest in the Vicuña sort of copper district is because it looks like it's set to be another giant metals district. To the listener sort of unfamiliar with the Vicuña story, what should investors be paying attention to here, Jamie?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's 40% of the world's copper comes from this slice of the Andes. And you mentioned a couple of them, but start from the top, Colwezi, Chuquicamata, Escondida, to our south, Andina, El Teniente. I mean, these are the giants of the copper mining industry. It's amazing how, that well-off and cited sort of 80-20 rule holds. And that's exactly what makes people excited about these giant metal deposits. It's, 20% of the value, or 20% of all the sort of the value from these base metals mines, 20% of those mines produce 80% of the value, I guess is the way to start thinking of it. So most of the industry's value drivers come from a handful of these giant deposits. And that's really what sets the stage for Vicuña. That's why the likes of a BHP is interested here, because we think we're on to what looks like another one of these industry giants. It's not one deposit. It's multiple deposits. It's a clustering of deposits. It's got scale. It's got grade. It sort of has all the earmarks of being one of these next great copper mining districts.
And Jamie, there's another facet which we're also pretty unfamiliar with here in Australia, being an island, but that the asset, or that the ore body, straddles both Argentina and Chile. So as we understand it, there's a bilateral agreement between the two governing how these things sort of progress. But how do you practically think through that? Is it twice as many environmental approvals, approvals with the native titles and all these sorts of things, government tax treaties and the like? Or does that sort of agreement between the two countries make things a bit easier for you?
Well, I'll separate that out into two stages, right? There's where we're at right now, which is exploration. And at least at this part of the project's history, it's fantastic. We have this agreement that exists. It effectively, we sort of control the border ourselves. So really the only rules are if you go in from Chile, you have to exit the project from Chile and vice versa. But what that means is we can supply fuel from either country or drilling equipment from either country, drillers. We can, you know, drill in Argentina with Chilean rigs and vice versa. So from an exploration perspective, it's fantastic. Obviously, complications as you start moving towards production. And what it means really is a duplicate of reporting more than a duplicate of effort. You know, just as with any project, you sort of have your ore deposit. You define your area of influence that would go around that. You complete all of your social, environmental baseline studies, flora and fauna, the hydrogeological work around that area of influence. And our area of influence just happens to encompass parts of Chile and Argentina. And then those go into your environmental impact statements when it's time to start permitting. So, you know, it means that we're moving those impact statements forward on both countries. But the actual body of work that goes into collecting the data is no different than any other project.
And Argentina, as a jurisdiction, we've heard quite a bit lately about the sort of instability. They've got elections coming up. They've got extremely high levels of inflation. They've governments defaulted on debt numerous times in the past. How do you sort of work around a lot of those issues, in particularly the currency one? I'm keen to hear what you think on.
It's probably been the single biggest reason, guys, that Argentina has suffered from foreign investment over the years. Really, is you know, you look at a lot of those big projects that we named off earlier on the show, and many of those sit on the Chilean side, not because the geology is any different, but because the fiscal regime has been more favorable to foreign investment in Chile. And I think the challenge in Argentina, really at the moment is right around that currency control. The issue is that there's restrictions on US dollars, how much you can bring in and how much you can export. So if you're going to put X billion of dollars of capital at work in Argentina, you know, as a company, as a lender, anybody who'd be sort of financially interested is going to want to make sure there's a mechanism to get those dollars out, whether or not that's returning it to shareholders or repaying debt. So that's the big, I think, nut to crack for Argentina. And they're in the midst of an election cycle right now. We should have a new government sometime later this year with the sort of the first round coming in a couple of weeks. Cautious optimism, I think, that sort of battling inflation and changes to these currency control rules to try and encourage investment across all sectors, not only mining, it's oil and gas, it's agriculture, but cautious optimism, I think, that there'll be a better path forward.
Jamie, can you help tease out that currency control issue a bit for us? Because I understand that it's a big deterrent, and the regulations sort of require companies to convert export receivables to pesos and to pay tax upon repatriation to the corporate level. Like, in practical terms, you know, you don't want that exposure to the peso, and that's the massive deterrent that, you know, investors face. Is that how it works out, or can you tease that out?
Yeah, exactly. And let's say I'm up and running and we're producing copper concentrate, and I sell my copper concentrate to Boliden or Rubis or Glencore, you know, I'll get US dollars in payment for that. And that has to come back into Argentina, where it then gets converted into pesos, and you build up a peso balance in country with restrictions then on being able to repatriate those pesos back to, you know, Canadian head office where we would happen to be, or return it to shareholders. And that's the challenge. They have started some work. There was a new law that was passed where there's sort of some holidays around that. So one of the new regimes. It fluctuates depending on how much you invest in country, but you sort of got a period of time where you're allowed to keep upwards of 60% of revenues generated offshore without having to bring it in country and convert into pesos. And that's for new investment in country. And those are the types of initiatives that, you know, I think the mining industry needs to get behind and build on over time, and then get certainty that those, you know, that you've got a longer runway to that ultimately before big decisions are being made. But we're starting to see, I think, the larger mining companies globally get more comfortable that Argentina is going to move in that direction. You've seen Rio Tinto involved in lithium space. Clearly, lots of your Australian companies heavily involved in lithium there. BHP, Lundin Mining, getting involved now in the copper space. You've got South 32 there as well. So I think it's interest is picking up.
And how much, you mentioned before, Jose Maria, just not too far, 14 odd Ks, I think, away from you guys. How much of a sort of proxy are they? Can you just follow? They're, I guess, a couple of years ahead of what Filo currently is. Can you just sort of look to see what they're doing and follow in the footsteps? Is that the way you look at it?
Yeah, exactly. Ride the coattails of Big Brother a little bit.
There was one more sort of aspect in how Latin America works as a mining jurisdiction that I want to kind of flesh out with you. So we spoke about a while ago, Quellaveco, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, the Anglo-American asset in Peru. And from discovery until mining, that took almost 3 decades. And there were a number of hurdles that the company had to overcome. And one of the key ones was the community engagement and getting the local communities on board. Is that issue as sort of pronounced in Argentina as it is in the likes of Peru?
Every jurisdiction's different, and it wouldn't be fair to even paint Argentina with a sort of a broad brush. You're going to face different issues in the northern part of the country as you would in the southern part. You know, where we happen to be is San Juan province, and we touched on it earlier, that the projects are remote, they're at high altitude, and so that comes with a level of complexity in terms of infrastructure challenges. But what you benefit from, of course, is there's no communities anywhere nearby. So, you know, as a result, we're pretty fortunate that the people that are in and around our projects are sort of 250, 300 kilometers away, very supportive of mining, largely as it's sort of a not in my backyard scenario, because it's legitimately not in their backyard. It's sort of happening up in the Andes and out of sight. So benefits for sure for us, and certainly in other areas of Latin America, whether it's in Peru, you've got, you know, community issues that tend to be a little closer to home from some of those bigger mining operations. So it's something that we all have sort of soft issues to work through as you look towards putting one of these big projects into production. And, you know, we have our own set of challenges.
Gotcha. I'm keen to talk about mining now. I can see Maddie's itching to talk about actually mining.
I was thinking, we'll skip that question. Let's get into the mining.
Yeah.
Mate, and because with these, first, I'll just a quick question. This is an epithermal porphyry deposit, and we hear about porphyry deposits. What's the quick sum up of the difference?
Well, what we have on top is a precious metals rich zone, and it tends to come with sort of different styles and different types of mineralization. You know, classic sort of South American copper gold porphyry, that the primary copper bearing mineral there would be chalcopyrite. And it would tend to a really nice, clean copper concentrate, but those deposits tend to be slightly lower grade. What we're seeing at Filo is substantial grades in some parts. I mean, we've got intersections that ran up over 30% copper. So you've got slightly more exotic copper-bearing mineralizations, largely a part of that sort of epithermal overprint. So, you know, that comes with it higher grades and more density of metal, but it also brings with some nasties. So we'll have areas of the deposit that you need to deal with arsenic and antimony and bismuth and some of the things that you don't necessarily want reporting to the copper con. So it's It's nice to have the, it's certainly nice to have the grade, and that grade covers the, you know, additional costs once we ultimately get into to processing. But that's sort of, I guess, the way you can think about Filo being unique with that epithermal system.
I guess for the money miners listening, when we say porphyry, that means fucking huge, like just big. Porphyry systems are huge. Best way to sum it up in Australia. And look, the slogan, your slogan is the world needs more copper. Like, yeah, you have to get to the point of mining. When you're exploring for a deposit like this, where do you draw the line of exploration to production? Because you've obviously got years and years of production already explored for right now. Where do you start drawing the line to where too much is too much?
Yes, really the fundamental question we ask ourselves as management and as the board every day is sort of how big is big enough. What we see at Filo right now is that we're clearly on that steep part of the learning curve. We're finding new areas of mineralization. We're filling in very critical gaps of our resource model. And in parts where we've already drilled, we're increasing the confidence of our knowledge in those parts as well with the drill bit. So certainly what we see right now and what our big supporters, whether it's the Lundins or BHP, it's, hey, we're interested in understanding where are the limits of this thing. And we haven't yet figured that out. We're still in mineralization 1.8 kilometers from surface. We haven't drilled out of it at the bottom, north, south, east, west, where despite sort of 120,000 plus meters of drilling that we've put into this thing, we have yet to find the edges. And that's the goal at this point in time. We're not going to drill that off ultimately to, in Canadian terms, measure, you know, our measured and indicated NI 43-101 resource reporting. But we at least need to get a couple of holes out to those edges to understand where the blue sky sits. And that's the goal.
And when you are drilling out these massive porphyries, what drill spacing defines to get it to actually into that indicated category from the inferred? I assume it's very different to a small, needing 20 meter spacings on a veiny gold deposit. How do you get it into an indicated category?
Yeah, we're probably looking at close to 200 meter centers. And there'll be some discussion, I'm sure Bob, my VP exploration, is going to want us to get down to 100 meter centers, which adds a significant more amount of drilling in there. But that costs a lot
of money, Bob, if you're listening.
Yeah. Some of the higher grade stuff, though, we're going to have to drill off to tighter centers as well, like that hole 41, which was a pretty special one for us that we announced in May of 2021. That was that 858 meter intersection of 1.8% copper equivalent. But within that, there was a 160 some odd meter section of greater than 5.5% copper equivalent. So where we see discrete areas of substantially higher grade, then we're going to have to go in and tighten up the drill spacing in those areas. But for the most part, it's sort of a bulk homogeneous deposit, and we can drill it off at wider spacing.
So your updated PFS that come out earlier this year. So it's a big open pit heap leach operation. Obviously, the logical place to start with. You're pretty much cutting out a mountain. So strip ratio is on your side at 1.57. But how do you analyze these massive porphyry deposits? As you said, you're still hitting mineralization 1.8 kilometers deep. How do you weigh them up in an open pit versus underground sense?
The topography here works in our favor. So certainly at this point in time, we're thinking this is going to be a giant super pit. And we had the benefit of visiting Escondida with our friends at BHP earlier this year. They really put in perspective what does a 5 kilometer by 5 kilometer super pit look like in the Andes, and that's a Filo sized pit. So that's exactly how we're sort of thinking of it. You know, you go through the oxides and just keep mining until you sort of run out of an ability to keep that open pit going. And what we're seeing now is that there's likely going to be a transition at some point in time at Filo, where it moves into bulk underground mining, whether or not that's caving. But that time's probably 40, 50, 60 years out in the future.
And what's it like in remote areas like the Andes, if you do these massive, massive open pits? I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think I just Googled Escondida's like 650 metres deep. With such bulk tons, getting diesel supply for the trucks, whereas if you go underground with the big block cave, I know it's obviously a big capital and big delay to get there, but then you can utilise things like solar power. But how does diesel supply work in the Andes?
Yeah, I mean, there's a handful of operations that are working at, at that same topography, same elevation. Veladero is, the largest operation comparable to us, and they're 100 kilometers to our south, still sitting at above 4,000 meters. And they've been fine, actually. The supply chain into Chile is reasonable. We're about 100 and some odd kilometers from the town of Copiapó, which is a mining hub, and the topography is pretty steep. So that drive is largely flat, and then you climb up into the mountain range. So access to diesel isn't an issue. Ultimately, this is an area that's going to be ripe for new technologies and renewable energies. There's tons of wind. It's right on the ridge, as well as being one of the most solar intensive places in the world. So, as I imagine, as the more advanced projects like Jose Maria start looking at that, it brings all sorts of things in terms of autonomous haul trucks, electric assist, that kind of thing, as they start thinking about, how to deploy new technologies into a big mining operation in the Andes.
Because I think when you talk about underground, as you said, it's decades into the future. So because your current sulfide mineral resource grade is what, 0.31% copper and 0.34 grams per tonne gold. Is that, what's the confidence level on that at the moment? Is there a lot more drilling to define deeper? Like you mentioned, higher, like the very high grades, but look, all those, the current sulfide resource grades look lower than all Oyu Tolgoi, KDR East, Casabel, Wafi Golpu, which are all caving operations. But is there?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess what information have you got there for those grades?
Well, that remnant sulfide resource that's there is basically the bottom of the holes. So imagine the first 15 years of drilling at Filo when we were defining the oxides. Once you transition it to oxide mineralization and got into sulfides, then we stopped the drill and we moved it on to the next target. So what that resource is effectively categorizing the bottom of those drill holes and has nothing to do with the drilling that we've advanced over the past 3 years. So the stuff that we're into now in an area we call Aurora, an area we call Bonita, the grades are going to be at least 3 to upwards of 10 times those types of grades, and so that's gonna form the bulk of the ultimate mine plan at Filo once you move into the sulfides.
So when is that resource update scheduled to come out?
Yeah, good question. we're not really guiding. I think the challenge, of course, is that mix between infill drilling and getting confidence in that resource versus continuing to explore and find the edges of the system. And so far, the strategy for us has been the latter. I think once we wrap our head around just how big it is, then we'll figure out a plan on what makes sense in terms of updating that sulfide resource.
There's no guidance on the mineral resource, Matty.
Jamie, on the sulfides, it's seen in some of the initial test work that there was a quite high level of arsenic in one of the samples. How do you guys sort of view that? Or is the focus mainly on just getting the oxides, is that it will be mined, much, much sooner all through the test works and everything, and leave the testing for the sulfides in more detail later on?
No, I think you need to bring the metallurgical test work for these big projects is so critical. You need to bring that along and move it alongside the discovery stage of the project too. So we've got another big MET program planned this year. And, there's no question that we'll have parts of the deposit that are going to be high in deleterious elements, and we'll have to figure out how to treat that. We've taken that through preliminary test work. What's common in this part of the world in the Andes with these big porphyries that are high in arsenic is that you've got partial roasting technology where you volatilize the arsenic and then you capture it and stabilize it for long-term storage. And that's what you see at a lot of Codelco's operations that are high in arsenic. So there'll likely be a portion of this population that that we see at Filo that we'll need to treat, whether that's through blending or partial roasting. But the nice thing is we've got those are all treatable issues that just take a little bit of additional cost, and we've got the grade to deal with that.
So the MET test work you did in the updated PFS, I think I'll say there was three samples. There was two low arsenic samples and one very high arsenic sample. The two low ones come back with a 0.1% concentrate, and the high one come back with 5.2% arsenic in the con. Were you testing, was that high arsenic one, is that a common one, or is that like the end of the spectrum? Were these tests the either end of the spectrum to see how the con is behaving?
We were trying to test the end, the goalposts, the ends of the spectrum. What does the stuff look like that's going to be the highest in arsenic? What does the stuff look like that's going to be sort of lower and more traditional? And we're going to have multi-billion tons here of sulfide material that's at that low end of the spectrum. And then there'll probably be a substantial, a couple hundred million tons of the really high stuff as well. So planning for that in the future, how you want to think about blending, how you want to think about future treatment is for the engineers to figure out right now. It's just understand the different populations and make sure you've got viable treatment solutions for both of them.
Is that arsenic, the higher arsenic levels, is it more prevalent in the deeper sulfide part, or is it more prevalent in the oxide part of the ore body, or is it just in pockets everywhere?
It's sort of in pockets everywhere. It's more prevalent where we're seeing that, the epithermal overprinting, and it comes with arsenic bearing copper minerals. So, tenantite and argite, those types of things, which are right in the midst of our Aurora zone where we see some of our best grades. The stuff that you have in the oxides, the nice thing about a heap leach process is it leaves all that behind. So it just sits in the spent leach pads and doesn't get disturbed. So you don't have to worry about it through the oxide part of the project.
I suppose for the money miners listening, the reason arsenic is such an issue is that in 2019, China reduced the level of arsenic in copper concentrates that they will accept from 0.5% to 0.4%. So
at the smelters.
Yeah, at the smelters. So do they just pretty much give you a big kick up the arse and send it back to you and not pay for it? Is that how it works in the copper con world, Jamie?
Yeah, sort of call it 0.5%. They'll take it. Anything above sort of 0.5 and call it 1 or something like that, then there's ways that you can sell it. There's smelters around the world that'll take that kind of material, and they'll just charge you for the penalty level.
Is that in mostly in Russia, is it?
Well, no, there's Chelopech in Bulgaria. Glencore's got some, ability to deal with it. Even Canada, the Horne smelter, various bits and pieces around the world. So, I mean, you can sell it. The traders will take it, Trafigura and Glencore, and they'll figure out ways to blend it out and make a lot of money on that stuff as well. So what you want to try and do is make sure that you've got a plan and a good plan internally to deal with it yourself. So the idea being, there's technologies like this partial roasting. You can take upwards of a 12% arsenic copper concentrate, put it through a partial roaster, and knock that down to saleable concentrate levels where you can then send it into China or Japan or any of the other, major fields. So that's when you've got a deposit like Filo and you've got the size and the grade to pay for the capital for one of those roasters, that's how you deal with it.
Is that roaster purely dedicated to the arsenic issue, or is it also for the sulfides and the refractory component, or it doesn't come into account because you're just selling a concentrate?
The simplistic way to think of it, it's just to deal with the arsenic.
Yeah, and that's pretty. And as you said, that you mentioned Codelco were using it as well. Is it pretty proven technology for dealing with the arsenic?
It is. Yeah, Minister O'Hale's a number of the higher arsenic copper porphyries on the Chilean side, deal with it like that.
So, Jamie, I know every explorer hates talking about CapEx, But as you can see, we're a mining podcast, not an exploration podcast. So
pretty much talk about CapEx every day.
So we talk about the practicalities rather than the blue sky upside a bit more than most interviews, I'm sure. And I guess to go along with that theme, I'm pretty keen to understand, you know, the constraints around water from sort of the location that that the project is in. Am I correct in my interpretation that to kind of get the most out of the project in the long run, it'd probably require a desalination plant and a pipeline from the coast to provide that water?
You know, it's one of the big benefits of being in Argentina. The bulk of our deposit, 90% of what's sort of what we found and almost all of the drilling that we're doing right now is entirely in Argentina. And we have access to groundwater there, which is a huge benefit. So we drilled off for the groundwater resource in combination with our friends at Jose Maria when they were putting through their feasibility study work there. So there's sufficient groundwater resources within the district to support ongoing mining using that, you know, groundwater. I guess plan B is interesting in the sense of preparing for whether or not rules or regulations may change in the future. And this comes a little bit to the broader Lundin Group build out of infrastructure within this part of the world. So for those listeners who aren't as familiar, Lundin Mining, which is the big base metals company, is part of the Lundin Group. They have two assets in Chile that are quite close to where we are. They've got the Candelaria copper mining complex, which is in the town of Copiapó, about 70 kilometers from the coast. And at the coast, they've actually got a desalination plant already built, as well as a port that only operates about 4 days of the 4 days of the month. So excess capacity in terms of supporting desalinated water to Copiapó. And then recently they've made the purchase of the Caserones mine, which was previously run by the Japanese. And that sits very close to Filo, about 30 kilometers to our north. And what's interesting about Caserones is they've already got a full sort of groundwater pumping system that effectively takes groundwater from around the Copiapó Valley, pumps it 100 kilometers up to altitude at Caserones. So, you know, the long-term, I guess, plan B here is it wouldn't take that much for the broader Lundin Group to think about building out that desalination facility, tying into the Caserones water pipeline, and then ultimately being able to deliver desalinated water up to the high Andes, which is, you know, exactly what we see happening at Escondida. They've got a 4,000 liter, you know, per second desalination facility at the coast that's pumping water up to 3.5 kilometers above sea level. So, I mean, that's how they've managed it because they don't have access to groundwater in Chile. So we basically got, I guess, plan A and plan B.
Is that groundwater, is that hypersaline or is it actual fresh groundwater that you have access to now?
It's actual fresh groundwater. Yeah, it's actually almost a neutral pH in all of the testing that we've done and very, very clean.
And would the amount of groundwater there now support a 22 million tonne per annum processing plant, or that's when you would need additional feed for that?
Yeah, we that'll support it right now. In fact, it supports that plus the Jose Maria asset, I think, of throughput in sort of tons per day. And that was a 150,000 ton a day milling facility that was going through at Jose Maria, plus ours at Filo del Sol. So certainly the resource that we've identified today is supportive of that. Lots more to discover and hopefully future expansions. And this is a huge mining complex. So who knows whether or not it's got capacity, you know, to where we ultimately get to in size. And that's why having that additional plan, that additional sort of desalinated plan as a backup option is pretty special.
Your point on shared infrastructure as well received. I think I looked at the Vicuña region and you see the area sort of controlled by these juniors, which share a common major shareholder in the Lundin Group. And I was sort of reminded thinking of the Pilbara region in Western Australia, the iron ore province, when that sort of became a new hotspot. One common theme in the Pilbara is duplication of infrastructure. The emerging producers couldn't agree to share any infrastructure, so they built like parallel railroads and all the rest. I kind of think about Vicuña in a sense, you know, hopefully given the fact that they share a common major shareholder, there can be some degree of alignment when it comes to sharing major infrastructure that's required to sort of bring the province online.
Yeah, I mean, that's the dream, right? We see it in North America and in Nevada between, you know, Newmont and Barrick as well. It's these spectacular area of the world with a significant endowment of metal, and yet, you know, duplicate structures and infrastructure being built all over the place. And that, this is the incredible opportunity that we have sitting in front of us today within this Vicuña district is a bit of a blank slate. And potential for you know, Lundin Mining and whoever ultimately partners to think about consolidating this region and ultimately building out infrastructure fit for purpose and expand it over time without duplicating things.
You sort of touched on it there, partnering, Jamie, and we've sort of seen a bit of consolidation. Like, a lot of these companies were spun out of NGEX to start. You've got, you know, Filo, Jose Maria, and then Jose Maria was acquired a couple years ago now by Lundin Mining. How do you sort of think about a partnering process or any sort of more consolidation in the area? Do you anticipate it between others?
Re-merging the merged. Re-merging the unmerged.
Demerged. Re-merging, exactly. Jamming it all back together.
You'll share the same office, don't you?
We do now. Yeah. These big projects, it's been a successful, I guess, development path for many of them in sort of the Chilean, Peruvian copper belts, right? You think of Antamina, which has multiple operating partners and financial and or offtake partners. And I think that's exactly the kind of thing that makes a lot of sense here. The Lundin family is clearly going to want to stay involved, and they're building out assets and infrastructure within the area through Lundin Mining. But I think that, you know, the goal here is to probably bring in partners that can help share the risk and bring their technical expertise and their financial balance sheet to ultimately, you know, turn this what is a dream into actually a pretty significant copper mining complex over time. And that could be Lundin Mining plus, you know, one of the big guys, whether it's BHP or Rio or Anglo or anybody else who might want to be involved. You've got, you know, the financial partners from the Japanese offtake we're starting to see the Middle Eastern entities get more active in that sense as well. So at this point in time, you know, I think everything's sort of on the table in terms of what makes sense and how do we come up with how do Lundin's come up with a plan on moving this forward so that, you know, they can hold on to as much as possible.
I mean, is this a bit of a financing ad for BHP and Rio? It's like in the paper, just letting them know the boys are interested in a call.
It's an interesting point you talk about there, touching on the financing, Maddie, because I look at BHP, you know, now on your register with 6%, you say, and I'm curious to sort of understand how you think about financing FDS as the project advances. I look at BHP there, and I can't help but, you know, have a bit of my memory flash back to SolGold. Now BHP on SolGold register, and I remember SolGold, you know, doing a financing deal. They raised about $50 million via a 0.6% royalty over their project there. And Mike Henry, CEO of BHP, had some curious words about
so
that deal.
So did Sandeep Biswas from Newcrest. Exactly. They were both fucking pissed off.
Totally. And I mean, I guess I'm pretty curious to understand, Jamie, is it fair to say that royalty finance is a long way from being considered at the moment to maintain, you know, corporate appeal?
Because you know yeah. BHP don't like it.
I think my personal opinion is you keep royalty financing, offtake financing, any of that kind of stuff right to the last minute when you've got the you know, the project sort of fully specced out and baked, and that's when you're going to get the maximum value for it, and make sure that at least up until that time you keep it completely unencumbered. So that the likes of a BHP aren't going to be dissuaded by a crappy deal that you've put on the asset.
I think BHP would like a royalty if they got the royalty. That's it.
And then I guess, like, you know, the broader kind of corporate appeal, like, how do you think about BHP's involvement? I know you've got a bit of a partnership. You mentioned BHP taking yourself to Escondida, you know, earlier this year. Like, what does their involvement actually look like? How do you envisage that partnership manifesting in the future? And what do you think their you know, ambitions are for the whole region?
It's been incredibly collaborative so far. It's actually been fantastic. We, as part of their original investment, we established a joint advisory committee. And as part of that joint advisory committee, we had quarterly meetings that were set up. So we sit down with them four times a year and give them an update on exploration, our strategy, where we're thinking of drilling, what the resources, the resource outline is sort of starting to look like, an opportunity for them to share ideas on, metallurgical test work, or, as you can imagine, you know, BHP has a slew of geophysicists on staff and I have none. So, you know, they can opine on some of the geophysics work that we've done and say, hey, this is a technique we'd love to see you implement here. And we, you know, we've traded ideas like that. So it's been great. Ultimately, that sort of has helped that we're all pulling in the same direction. And it would have been easy, I guess, for there to be a divergence there. One group could have come in and said, listen, we don't care about the blue sky or the upside. We know you've got something great at Filo. You just need to drill this thing off. We want you to race to an initial resource and put a mine plan around that. Let's get going. Whereas our interests, I think, have been aligned, and let's take our time and figure out just how big it is and you know, what we think the ultimate blue sky here is. I think what they want, you know, what they're getting out of it, and Mike's been pretty clear about this in conversations, is when they're contemplating a new potential mining district or in Argentina where they don't have a presence today. It's nice to be able to go in and leverage the experience of groups that do have a long history there. And that's exactly what the Lundins sort of bring to the table, is 30 years of operating in Argentina, 30 years plus of building local relationships, building relationships at the federal level and whatnot. So it's a chance for them to sort of leverage our historic foothold in country as well.
Do you think BHP and, look, Rio as well, who they're both owners of Escondida, with the world venturing towards electrification, do you think they look at deposits like this and they will attack them a lot differently to how they attacked Escondida historically, but like trying to avoid the massive footprints, high diesel usage, and more looking towards underground and electrification?
I think it's probably something the mining industry needs to spend a bit more time and effort on, is growing our sort of implementation of new technologies to try and reduce the environmental footprint of these big things. The one sort of counterpoint is that is the benefit of these giant operations that are high grade, is that you sort of centralize, let's accept the fact that we're putting big holes in the ground. This is an opportunity to centralize that and at least make sure that, all of the scale of multiple deposits can share that infrastructure. So you're not duplicating processing plants, you're not duplicating tailings facilities or roads or access. You can leverage some of those big infrastructure items that have substantial environmental footprint with a substantial mining district that's going to be there for a really long time, as opposed to having, let's call it multiple little tiny mines all over the place where you're creating impact in many, many different areas spread out. And the same can be said about trying to chase higher grade. And, Robert Friedland's the key for this one. He sort of says, go to the DRC where the grades are 4-5%, and you're using, when you're dealing with 10 times better grade, you're using 10 times less steel, 10 times less fuel, 10 times less energy, that kind of thing. And so that sort of also rings true in South America and some of the stuff that we're finding here. And it's why some of the higher grades that you see at Filo also play into that.
Beauty. Boys, you got anything else?
I'm all out. It was fascinating to hear about an operation in a different part of the world to what we focus on. So appreciate you coming on, Jamie.
I've got one, Jamie. One last one. Genuinely, what keeps you up at night when you're thinking about the project?
I got a bunch of guys running around in the high Andes and water trucks, and it's remote weather. I think, you know, anybody who's running an exploration program or is in charge of people out there, I worry for people's, you know, safety. It's not the easiest environment, and I think we all deserve to come home after a day's work. So, you know, it always keeps me up at night that I'm going to get a nasty phone call, that something bad's happened on the project. Knock on wood, we've had a pretty spectacular safety record so far, but hopefully we can keep that going.
Have you got any questions for us, Jamie? You might get sick of talking about yourself sometimes.
Yeah, listen, I've been a fan. Trevor's the guy. Trevor's our VP of Corp Dev and IR. He's the guy who sort of put me onto you guys, and he's watched it a little bit. I saw the. What did I see? Did you have Warren Gilman on the other day?
And you
made him do a bit of a pick of a whole bunch of stock tickers at the end.
Yeah, the underrated, overrated
as well. Yeah, underrated, overrated, and so it popped up on my feed because he had some nice things to say about Philo. So it's been, I think you guys are doing a great job. We don't have anything like this in North America, and. Trevor and I visited, I was in Australia in April this year. We ran through Perth and Melbourne and Sydney, and it's just been, it was awesome. I think interesting to see the number of people that talked about us and potentially listing on the ASX. And you think back to sort of 15 years ago, and it would have been the exact opposite. You had all these sort of Australian companies trying to vie for capital in Canada and wanting to list in the TSX. And I think it's reflective of sort of the amount of capital that's there and the genuine understanding of mining that Australian market has. So
it probably also has something to do with the fact that we've got absolutely sweet fuck all good copper stories on the ASX.
not many copper porphyry over here.
Well, it's right, eh? After Oz Minerals was taken out, it's the sort of slim pickings.
Yeah.
Very much. Right, mate. Thanks very much for coming on. Always good to head across the ditch and mix it up for the money miners. So, yeah, really appreciate it, mate.
Cheers, Jamie.
Best of luck with the drill bit.
Thank you very much.
Hopefully it's not down to luck.
You're welcome to invite us to the Andes to smoke a dart 4,000 metres above sea level too.
Yeah, I know. I'll probably pass out, but bloody, yeah. Probably too risky taking us up. You'll have one of those safety incidents that you're trying to avoid.
Thanks, Jamie.
Cheers.
Thanks, guys.
Right, boys, what do you reckon?
Awesome scale discovery. You know, fascinating to hear how they're going to try and keep expanding the discovery and then potentially develop it in the future. I found it super interesting to learn about everything going on. You know, the Lundin family, you got the Caserones mine and all of that going ahead. So, yeah, a lot to get up on and a lot we don't talk about so much here.
A lot of chapters to go in that book too. Mm. Very, very early days, but as we discussed, there's a point where you sort of,
yeah, mate, the world needs more copper, and hopefully these guys can turn it in not decades in the future, but this can be a copper mine in the not too distant future.
I think it's pretty easy to have a decade plus heap leach open pit running while you can potentially drill the fuck out of it and go deep and go down a block cave route as well. It's not a bad not a bad cash model.
I'd love to chat with Adam Lundin. The Lundin family are the kingmakers in this region, and I'd really love to chat with him about the overarching strategy here.
Yeah,
just give me a call, mate. We'll fit you in, mate. That'd be great.
Squeeze me in along with Gina and Chris.
Yeah. Oh, look, dude. If Adam calls straight away, he goes straight to the top because obviously Gina and Chris haven't been in contact. So, Ads will put you above Gina, Reinhardt and Chris Ellison.
They can go on the back burner. Hey?
Yeah, we'll chuck them on the bench.
Perfect. Couple sponsors to thank, guys.
Oh, yeah, the Anytime, Anywhere, Any Altitude Exploration Services, Seamus Murphy. Give them a call before they get the Philo contract.
That's it. K-Drill, Terra Capital, JP Search. And
Smec Power and Technology, mate. This would be a good spot to install some batteries and solar and bloody all sorts of power things over there. We'll get them we'll pretty much get, if we get Smec, K-Drill, Anytime, the contracts over there, and then when they start developing a white-collar workforce. We'll get JP Search to recruit for them. Mate, we'll make a... Talk about referral fees.
Mate, we'll just hook on a royalty onto all their revenue streams. We'll be laughing.
My money of mine has officially modified the business model as of today. Love Boys, it. Cheers for that. And thanks, Jamie, for coming on.
Hootaroo.
Hootaroo, money miners.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.